Mini episode 517 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by The Unheard Scene, your home for great music interviews of all stripes. Follow them on the web at unheardscene.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 517, here in person, talking hot stove baseball with two of my favorite FDH Lounge dignitaries for talking the Seamhead stuff. Ken Detweiler, for whom I was once a sidekick on Life's a Pitch with Ken Detweiler, coming back as a webcast, I understand, and be very happy to sidekick again for him. And my good friend, Steve Callis, fellow FDH Lounge dignitary. You can hear him, of course, on WFAN in New York, SNY, all kinds of other different places, and check out his columns at WFAN.com. Gentlemen, a pleasure to have you both on today here in person. Steve, while you're in Cleveland, we welcome you here with this absolutely horrid weather that we have going on. And a pleasure to get to convene in person and talk some hot stove baseball with you guys.
Great to be with both of you guys. Same here. Finally, nice to meet Steve here. And always a pleasure with you, Rick.
Thank you. Thank you. And yeah, you know, you've done some segments with Steve before and Will again subsequently, both on this show. And hey, with Life's a Pitch coming back, more on that, I guess, in the days to come, huh? We'll have some more details for the folks out there who used to love that old show, me, you, and Don Koster, and a cast of thousands back in the day, but primarily us. And a pleasure to be here with you guys talking hot stove baseball. And again, so much that has gone on in the last couple of months. We have a new commissioner in baseball. We'll be talking about that more towards the tail end. But as far as anything that's gone on this past winter, we've seen some teams sort of move into retrench mode, like the Atlanta Braves under their new general managership that they have there and the leadership of John Hart now in the front office. We've seen some teams like Houston and the Chicago Cubs continue to step up and try to make a move for next year, particularly the Cubs, and with the signing of Joe Maddon as manager, the signing of John Lester there. I'll start with you, Steve. What are some of the bigger eye-grabbers that you've seen in the offseason as far as teams really making a big move for next year and to really kind of step up? Because you can kind of count on one hand as we go into the season teams that aren't in it to any degree.
Well, I think at least in the AL East, where I'm from, of course, I looked at what the Red Sox did signing both Hanley Ramirez and Pablo Sandoval. I mean, to just change, totally change the left side of the infield, which, you know, frankly wasn't very good. I think they've vaulted themselves back in. Of course, I think they also thought they were going to get John Lester and didn't. I think, conversely, Theo Epstein, I think they might build a statue of him if they can win the World Series in Chicago, because to get Maddon away, and you know how that worked, he had an opt-out clause if the GM, if Friedman left, and he went to the Dodgers. So he was gone. I didn't like what they did to Rick Renteria. I thought that was pretty bad. You know, you can tell me it's business, and that's what Epstein said, but, you know, I was disappointed in that. But I certainly think that the Red Sox have reloaded. I'd love to say something positive about the Yankees, but especially since Ken is here in person, I know his love for the Yankees. Let the Yankee fans say the Yankees are in a lot of trouble this year, so I don't really have much. You know, what they did was they gave Brandon McCarthy, you know, a get-out-of-jail-free card, and, of course, Brandon McCarthy left, and he's gone to the Dodgers. And I think that's a good signing for the Dodgers, because at the end of the day, it's pitching, pitching, pitching. And I also think the other big signing I would just talk about, and then I'll give it over to Ken, is Scherzer going to the Nationals. I think he puts the Nationals right, and I know we're going to save this for another time. But Scherzer being on that pitching staff, which was already really good to begin with, any pitching staff that has Gio Gonzalez as the probable number five, assuming no other moves are made, they're going to be high up on the list. So I think those Red Sox in the AL East have reloaded. Tampa Bay has gone down. The Yankees, I think, hard for me to say, have gone down. But conversely, when you sign a guy in the National League, to go with Pfister, who is also a former Tiger, and Zimmerman, I mean, they have a heck of a rotation. So I thought those were the main ones. There were other ones, but I'll save a few for Ken.
Okay. What do you think, Ken?
Well, I'm going to take a different point of view, as far as the winter, what has really stood out for me has been the number of trades, the number of people just coming and going. Not trades so much as free agents.
Yeah, the combination.
Well,
I agree.
I mean, it's been – in recent memory, I can't remember so many teams just throwing money after money after money. And really, the White Sox, for example, being in the Midwest, the Padres, these guys are just – where does this money come from? You know, the Marlins, what was it?
Yeah.
They're going nuts. Duquette, the nonsense with that stuff. I mean, it's just like all the planets are aligned in craziness or something. I just – you know, you can't cry poor mouth like we hear here locally.
Yeah.
no names, please.
It's going to be unpleasant for you at the next
Dolan,
at the next family dinner, it's going to be a little unpleasant, Ken.
Yeah, I know. Well, I told you what I told – told you the other time about
you're my hero,
Mr. Dolan.
Yes,
at a family outing, you know, when he wanted to pay for dinner, keep it and get us a good hitter. went over like a lead balloon. But at any rate,
I wonder why.
It just amazes me. I'm watching the MLB, and this guy's coming in, this guy's going out. You know, the Nationals now for what, 2 or 3 years in a row, have the best pitching staff. Are they going to be able to compete and take that final step? The Yankees, I'm like you, Steve. Derek Jeter, although you know how I feel about the Yankees, has always been my favorite player. However, geez, it looks like a Cleveland team over there.
Yeah.
It's like, you like to see the Yankees keep that going in some weird sort of way, the 26 championships or whatever they have. But
haven't you at one point called the 26 rings around the toilet bowl?
Yeah, I think at one time maybe.
I remember that line from you.
I don't recall. but have you guys ever seen anything like this before? I mean, I've seen big blockbuster deals and stuff like that, but
yeah,
I've never seen it to this extent.
Well, a number of things too. When you're talking about this. Things that don't appear to make a whole lot of sense. Again. I understand Billy Bean works on another level that we're never going to comprehend as far as why things happen, but letting Brandon Moss go relatively cheaply, Josh Donaldson, guys who I think most of us would still think of as being fairly cheap and controllable for what they've done, where it really gets to that to be bizarre with me is when you're throwing a guy like, and I understand I'm a little bit biased owning him in our keeper league that we have, Ken, but Will Myers. Yeah. A year removed from being Rookie of the Year. I mean, for something like that, Steve, do you have any comprehension whatsoever? Tampa Bay's a team that I think a year ago all of us picked to win the American League. I know I did, and they didn't live up to it. But the dismantling of that team, they're still going to have a good pitching staff, but now it's pretty much official. Pitching staff and Evan Longoria, that seems like about all they're going to have. Why you trade a Will Myers kind of a guy? That's a guy that the rest of baseball will look at as a jewel that you want to build around. Disappointing year, but I don't think anybody reads anything into it. Combination of the sophomore jinx, being injured. This is not Joe Charbonneau part due. The guy is going to come back. He had a tremendous minor league pedigree. I scratch my head trying to figure something like that out, Steve, and we're seeing more and more of that in baseball.
Yeah, I think specifically to Tampa Bay, their GM left. Madden was out the door right after him. I've heard a number of times on the radio because the owner, I think it's Saul Sternberg, I think is his name. Mm-hmm. He's from New York, and he lives in New York, and he goes on the Fan in New York a lot.
Okay.
And he's been complaining. I know you guys will laugh, especially as Cleveland guys, but he's been complaining. As you know, Tampa Bay became good because they were so horrifically bad. I mean, they had 6 or 7 number one draft picks in a row and did really well drafting. Now, of course, they've been good. So the owner actually went on the radio to complain, and his pitch to Major League Baseball was, it shouldn't just be where we finish in the standings. There should be partly like 50% standings and 50% payroll. Mm-hmm. Now, we could debate that, and I don't want to do it here, and it's an interesting topic. But to me, it was sour grapes. Here's the guy who, you know, got David Price and got all these number one draft picks over the years, became good, including getting to a World Series and always being a competitor, and now, you know, complaining because things haven't gone well. So I had made a list. I just want to read to you the list of the guys who have left Tampa Bay. In addition to Joe Madden, who you could argue is one of the most important people leaving, but it's not just Will Myers. They got rid of Matt Joyce. Hellickson left. Joe Peralta's gone. Ryan Hannigan's gone. Ben Zobrist got traded. Yunel Escobar, a very good young shortstop. So I have to think. Now, look, I don't know how far away Myers is. I should know how far away he is from. I think it was more than that. I think there was something wrong down there for him because he just really flattened out and played poorly. I love Longoria, who doesn't, but he did not become the superstar we thought he was. They put
right.
all their money. You know, they didn't sign many people for a lot of money. They put all their money in Longoria, and I think he's an excellent player, but he did not take that next step to superstardom. So you're right. They're going to have a good pitching staff, but I think they're going the wrong way. I'm a Yankee guy. I think the Yankees are going the way. To Ken's point before, I think the interesting thing is in the old days of 10 years ago, you know, you knew the guys who were spending all the money.
Yeah.
Nowadays, and to what Ken said, you know, the San Diego Padres are spending money.
Yeah.
The White Sox, now, I know the White Sox, they have some money. They're Chicago. But, you know, they stole David Robertson from the Yankees, just being sarcastic. Melky Cabrera, you know, whatever we think of baseball and PEDs and the 50-game suspensions, Melky Cabrera has made a fortune and played well since then.
Mm-hmm.
Nelson Cruz has made a fortune and played well. I thought he should have stayed in Baltimore myself because that's a home run hitter's part. But the White Sox get Robertson, Cabrera, Adam LaRoche. They have Jeff Samardzija. And I saw that Samardzija is willing to talk, not necessarily sign, but willing to talk about a long-term extension with the White Sox. So what's that going to be?
Heard that too.
$15 million a year, $20 million a year if he has a good year this year. And the Padres also, they get Matt Kemp. They can pay his salary. Justin Upton, they can pay his salary. Will Myers. Now, Will Myers is only making, like, I think $500,000 a year. So I don't know how long they have him to. They signed Middlebrooks from the Red Sox, who was very good as a Red Sox and then fell off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
He signed a contract for like $500,000. So that's intelligent signing. But to pay for an Upton, a Kemp, and Carlos Quentin, they signed Derek Norris. And you're right. To Ken's point, where are teams like the San Diego Padres get? If the Yankees did it, no one would bat an eye. If anything, we'd complain they're spending too much money. But I think that's what Ken makes a good point.
Yeah.
I think that's the reason why it's these, I don't want to say secondary teams, but teams who 10 years ago wouldn't buy one expensive free agent.
Well, you know what? To that point, let me remind you for a second here. In terms of Matt Kemp, where did they get the money? A good part of it is the L.A. Dodgers TV money, because the Dodgers are on the hook for a good part of that. That's how desperate they were to get rid of that salary, is they're paying a good chunk of it. It reminds me of a couple of years ago in town here, and all these Indians homers would run around and like, $78 million payroll. And like, do any of you morons know or care that the Atlanta Braves are paying like 10 of the $15 million for Derek Lowe? You can't give credit to that to the Dolans. Because they're not picking up the tab for it. So once in a while, you're still seeing that if teams are desperate to kind of shed money a little bit. I think we saw that in some of the Boston and L.A. Dodger dealings a couple of years ago when Boston was trying to get out from underneath stuff, and now the Dodgers are. But, yeah, it's an excellent point, too, about Washington with their pitching staff and adding Scherzer to it, because the Dodgers and the Nationals, the teams I thought would be in the NLCS a year ago this time last year and still think are probably most likely the year upcoming, they keep making moves, those two franchises, to try to get to that point and to try to solidify. And, Ken, it's an interesting thing when you're looking at that we saw two teams in the World Series that, unless you're going by the numerology theory of it's an even-numbered year, I don't think any of us saw San Francisco coming at the beginning of the year.
No.
Kansas City, probably not.
No.
But so it's teams that emerged that we didn't necessarily see coming. But a lot of the teams that we were talking up this time a year ago remain the teams that we're talking up now because, again, the Nationals, the Dodgers, they continue to make moves to try to solidify. One of these years has to be the tipping point for one of these teams, it would seem like.
Well, and I saw something today on MLB Network. They were talking about could the ALCS be the same teams as in the Super Bowl.
Oh.
Seattle and Boston.
Possible.
Which makes you pause and think. Also, you've got a new, as Steve pointed out, the general managers of 10 years ago, how ancient that is. You've got a whole new breed of young general managers who are using sabermetrics.
Yeah.
I wonder if that has any bearing on some of this stuff. I'm sure it does to some point, but how much? Because some of these guys, like you said, Steve, and Rick also, doesn't make sense when you look on paper, like Myers and some of these players, why they're shipped out. Why are they, you know,
Well, it could be in some cases wondering how players kind of fit in with this landscape. And I will say this, that as I've been getting ready for Fantasy Baseball Draftology to come out, that'll be available soon on FantasyDraftHelp.com, our annual fantasy and non-fantasy guide for baseball. Did a study going back to 1968, the year before the expansion into two divisions, looking at the last 47 seasons in baseball, adding up just standard metrics, batting average, home runs per game, a couple others, ERA, WHIP, et cetera, averaging them all out. Last year, by this metric, was the 40th out of 47 of the past years in offense, 40th highest offense, so 7th lowest. So we're coming off a real depression here in terms of offense in the game, even beyond the whole thing about, you know, allegedly getting PEDs out of the game. And, Steve, this is something you and I had talked a little bit off air. The new commissioner of Major League Baseball, Rob Manfred, very sort of off the cuff almost in his initial remarks. Oh, I might be good with possibly outlawing certain kinds of shifts here. And So he just kind of like threw that around sort of, no pun intended, callously there without really kind of getting into it. But, you know, I know that you guys, as folks, both of you with some extensive managerial backgrounds in baseball, I know both of you guys have some thoughts. I'll be interested in hearing them. Let me start with you, Steve.
Well, I think Rob Manfred, I was never a big Bud Selig fan. When you can tell me all the great things he did to make, like Roger Goodell, to make the owners more money, to me, the first line of his obituary is going to be cancel the 1994 World Series and resign it over the PED era. I don't care what comes after that. Having said that, Rob Manfred, to me, is the clone. You know, they had the guy from Boston who they were trying to push, maybe, was it the guy from Friends?
Oh, Tom Warner?
Tom Warner, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he had some support early on, but then it became unanimous. So they just rubber-stamped whoever Bud Selig wanted. Yeah. And I have just a little experience with Manfred, because you guys will recall in the Alex Rodriguez arbitration hearing, Manfred was the guy who was on the panel. He was one of the three judges, I'm putting that in quotes, because the Players Association provided one, MLB provided one. And then as an attorney, when Manfred literally comes off the bench to testify against A-Rod and then goes back up to the bench to supposedly judge him, judge in quotes again, I was like, oh, my goodness, what? This is legal in America? But as we all knew and found out, it was a one-man arbitration with three guys who decided. So the baseball guys voting for baseball, the Players Association guys voting for A-Rod, and the guy in the middle is the one who suspended it or reduced his suspension like that was a victory. Mm-hmm. But whatever. So my concern with Manfred generally is he's a Bud Selig clone. Specifically with this, I don't know how you can actually rule in baseball. What, you can only have X guys on one side of the field? Or because here's what's going to happen, and I think we might have spoken about it, Rick. Suppose you say you can only have two infielders on each side of the field. You're going to have the shortstop standing directly behind second base. Mm-hmm. And maybe it'll be like the third base coach's box. Maybe he'll cheat a foot or two. Or maybe when the pitcher's winding up, he'll move. You don't know. You're going to have two outfielders. You can't tell me the center fielder has to be behind second base. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have, for a lefty I'm talking about now, which is the major shifts, Big Poppy or somebody, you're going to have the first baseman, the second baseman over, the shortstop behind second, the right fielder towards the line, the center fielder playing in right center. And who knows what they're going to do with the left fielder, because those guys hit the ball the opposite way about once every 50 at-bats, and that's, I guess, Ken, you could say, part of the beauty of sabermetrics, where you can now hit a button and see the 500 at-bats, the 420 times you hit the ball, where they went. And I think that's going to be hard. I think the answer for offense is, and I think this is going to change scouting, although I haven't seen any articles on this, you're going to now look for those guys who can go the other way. You're going to look for the guys with better back control. You're going to look for guys who can bunt, talk about a lost art. And Mark Teixeira every year says, oh, yeah, I've been practicing on my bunt, and I'm going to lace them down this year. And I think he just says it as a bluff because he never, ever, ever bluffs. Now, in his defense, you know, you're 35, 36, 38 years old, Big Poppy, who did bunt once in a while last year. You know, it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. It's like James Harrison in football where he said, you guys are telling me to tackle differently after I've played 20 years of football. And you know what? That's a good point. But I think down in colleges and the high schools where Ken coaches and even lower, I think there's going to be more of an emphasis, which I'm happy to hear about, frankly, on going the other way, on bunting. But I don't see how it could even be legal. I wonder if the Players Association would be upset if they band shifts. That would be interesting.
I would be interested to hear that as well. I want to get Ken's thoughts on that. I have to say also, too, you're really making me wish, by the way, that they had courtroom cameras there with Rob Manfred. I'd love to see the thing with him and the sock puppet. That was excellent testimony. Thank you, Your Honor.
It was unbelievable. That's all I'll say.
That must have really been something. You know, I know you were there taking it in and giving coverage on WFAN and WFAN.com, and that whole circus is something that, again, probably has to be seen to be believed. And, Ken, I don't know how much necessarily this has dribbled down to the high school level. I haven't really paid attention to that, but as far as shifting and some of the more sophisticated techniques. But Tom Verducci had he had actually written a column last summer, past lounge guest Tom Verducci, free plug, about I love to be shameless on that, about he had first sort of proposed that maybe there should be some rules dealing with shifts, because he was getting into extensive analysis of quoting what it was doing to the left-handed hitters and the way that offense was really, really being crushed there. So what I want to ask you is, has it dribbled down to some of the lower levels as far as shifting and some of these advanced techniques? And then additionally, what are your thoughts on what baseball can do to address the whole offensive crisis?
Well, I agree with Steve on the fact that I think it's going to be a good change. Mm-hmm. I think baseball has always changed with the times. Mm-hmm. You've had the dead ball era. You've had the PEDs. You've had, you know, all this other stuff. At the high school level, I know here in the area, and at the college level, where I think the best baseball, as we were talking earlier before mm-hmm. we went on air, is where the best baseball is played. This is worked on every day mm-hmm. from our freshmen on, because I know there are teams when I coach pitching mm-hmm. that – locally here, middle out on the plate, they're taught just to drive it to the opposite way mm-hmm. throughout their programs, and we do the same thing. And that's at 15- and 16-year-old kids mm-hmm. on up. And at the college level, I know they do it there too.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's an issue at the college level, or it's an issue. Shifts aren't – I've never seen a shift used, because kids – well, unless you have a dead pull hitter like you're talking about with Ortiz – and, you mm-hmm. know, to share and some of this other stuff, but the dead pull hitters, rather. I just don't get it. Let it play out. The game initially never had a pull hitter until, what was it, Ted Williams?
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of went away, and now it's back, and now everybody's whining and complaining, like kind of a, you know, a same look at our society. We whine and complain about stuff instead of fixing the thing. And yeah. The other thing is, if I'm, as a pitching coach, another ludicrous idea that should be thrown in the trash with the shifts, is my opinion only, is I bring in Steve to come in and pitch, but he's got to throw the three batters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not so sure that has to be.
Yeah.
There are other ways of speeding up the game. And so it's like, who makes up this stuff?
Yeah. Well, I know baseball's concerned, MLB, about the pace of the game, and that it is yeah. it is getting to be a thing that is increasingly repelling the younger generations, and, you know, OMG, yeah. youth are turning out baseball. So you're not as concerned about that?
No, I mean, if you're a baseball, as you and I know, mm-hmm. when we interviewed some of the Negro League players,
yes,
Buck O'Neill told us, I said, didn't you feel like you were, you know, treated unfairly, that you were, you know, mm-hmm. all the other stuff that went on with that stuff, how they weren't allowed to play? And he said, you know, the true baseball fan, mm-hmm. people who love baseball, they don't care what color you are or what the generations to come are. Mm-hmm. I'm just throwing that part in.
Mm-hmm.
They know a baseball player.
Right.
Whether you're 5 foot two, or whether you're Howard from back in the Washington Nationals or mm-hmm. the Washington Senators back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care. They go, this guy's a baseball player. This
right.
guy can play ball. I like to see him. Ichiro, as you brought up before we started talking,
mm-hmm.
that was a whole new batting stance when he came into the league.
Yeah.
Jeez, did we really care about what the younger generations thought about this or that? Or did I enjoyed and still enjoy how he plays the game. So, I, you know, well, maybe I'm a dinosaur.
My great uncle Al, God rest his soul, Didn't think he should be over here playing because of Pearl Harbor, but Great Uncle Al had he had his own reasons, you know, and stuff. And I'll never forget watching a game with him rookie year. I was like, Uncle Al, you think he should be eligible for rookie of the year? You remember how there was the debate about that with the Japanese? Like, I don't think he should even be over here playing. Like, okay, all right. I wasn't expecting that. That was coming from a weird place. But you're right about that. You know, we can, you know, as baseball fans recognize this, you know, greatness in players and, you know, hopefully the shift won't, you know, obscure that, you know, as we go forward. And that's one of the questions that I have. I mean, I think we all agree that, you know, some of the things that Manfred is talking about and just kind of throwing it around, it's kind of goofy because you have to put a lot of thought into what you're going to do. You have to really give it a lot of emphasis. My thought is, Steve, do you think that there's anything that they can or should do within, you know, the spirit of baseball tradition that is basically going to restore some of this offense here, or are we going to have to wait for it to be cyclical?
I think, and Ken speaks well to college and high school, I think scouts are going to look at players differently. If you're a pull hitter, you better be an awesome power pull hitter, because I think that's now going to be viewed to be negative. It was fascinating. I'll give you a story. I wrote a great article, and I don't usually say that, but I wrote a great article on Roberto Clemente that is now published every year on December 31st, the anniversary of his death, on WFAN.com. And I say it's great because it's the most researched thing I've ever done. And the knock on Clemente was that he didn't have power. And, of course, when you understand the history of Forbes Field, I don't want to go into it here, but, you know, your listeners could Google that article. It's really, really good. But while researching that article, Hank Greenberg played his final season in Pittsburgh, and it was also Ralph Kiner's second season, I believe, and Hank Greenberg taught Ralph Kiner how to pull the ball, and they had moved the left field fence in by like 35 or 40 feet for Hank Greenberg. But Greenberg only played 1 year and retired, but Kiner now is a dead pull hitter. Again, this is in the 40s and 50s, so the shift wouldn't come into play except maybe for Ted Williams. Lou Boudreau, as you guys know from Cleveland, was the one who invented the shift on Williams.
Mm-hmm.
But Kiner became a prolific home run hitter because he could pull the ball to, back then, what became a very short left field fence. And interesting, in the Clemente article, when Kiner was traded in 53 or 54, I think it was, they moved the fences back, and that's why Clemente didn't hit 30 home runs a year.
Mm-hmm.
No exaggeration.
Yeah.
But my point is, nowadays, when pull hitting used to be used, especially, look, Yankee Stadium, even today, you look for pull hitters, but Teixeira being a great example in Yankee Stadium, it's going to be viewed, and I think it's starting to be viewed at the major league level, as a minor negative, not a major negative. But I think when scouts go out and look now, they have a totally different view of a pull hitter. And my son played in these travel teams that Ken was talking about at a very high level. You know, he played with a kid named Colin Moran, who was the number 6 pick in the draft a few years ago. He's going to be in the major leagues.
Yeah.
And he is not a dead pull hitter, for example, Colin Moran. But my point is, just as Ken said, you are taught now. You do all this tee work. When I was a kid, we did very little tee work. That was 100 years ago. But you do all this tee work where you put the tee on the, if you're left-handed, the outside of the plate, the middle of the plate, the inside of the plate, or right-handed, of course, outside, middle, inside. And when it's inside, you're pulling the ball. When it's over the plate, you're hitting it right up the middle. When it's outside, it's the old, and Ken knows this, you do too, Rick, hit it where it's pitched.
Absolutely.
We talk about that all the time. But pull hitters don't hit it where it's pitched. So I think over time that's going to change. In terms of picking up the offense, boy, I don't know what to do, because we're comparing it now to the PED era, which is unfair.
Right.
And you'll recall in the, and I'm old enough, and Ken is too, to remember the 60s, mm-hmm. where it became the pitcher's decade, to the point when Gibson had the 1.12.
Right.
They lowered the mound. See, if you wanted to give the pitchers an advantage, you would raise the mound
mm-hmm.
back to where it was. But they've already done everything they can for that. The strike zone is like a little box.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did see, you know, Ted Williams did tee work. It was very interesting. And there's some film, maybe you can find it on the internet, where Ted Williams is hitting off tees, and the high ball, low ball tees that he hits off, the high ball tees are now 5 inches too high for a strike in today's game.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure. But if you told me that no shifts would increase offense, to me that just kind of plays with the fabric of the game. So I think, as everything is an adjustment in life, it's now time for the hitters. It's time for Teixeira to bunt 10 times a year.
Yeah.
All these guys have to do, and Ortiz does it once in a while, is literally just get the ball down, and if you hit it hard enough, you'll get a double.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to have to adjust. That's the change that has to be made, in my opinion.
Yeah, when, and I think it's a longer-term thing than what we're talking about of this winter, certainly, Ken.
Well, let me interject, too, a little bit with what you're saying, Steve, is back in the day, Ted Williams and these guys, some of these guys in the off-season were insurance or car salesmen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
These guys are paid gazillions of dollars, as we mentioned earlier in the show, and now you got every blessed day to work on this stuff with trainers and all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
It's like, if you're an athlete to this magnitude, make the adjustment, for goodness sakes.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. And that's what it's going to take. And we'll see if baseball tries to overmanage to get rid of this. I think some of the initial static that came Manfred's way after he said that, I think, is going to cause them to move at a more deliberate pace, I would think, Ken.
And you brought up a good point that caused me to pause, Rick, what you said about the younger generations and stuff.
Yeah.
Baseball is a sport, you know, here again, I'm old school, but baseball is a sport where father passes it down to his son. Grandfather goes with the grandson to the game. And they pass these stories down from, and you become a lover of the game simply through all these kind of connections in the families.
Yeah. And that's been interrupted, unfortunately, in a lot of families.
Yeah, see, and that's fascinating. But just as when we were kids, and the difference between, in my opinion, and having coached, not as much as Ken, but having coached a lot of them, when we were kids, baseball was a game of failure. Today, baseball is a game of failure. But we, maybe it was the way we grew up or the way our parents were, who were generally, you know, the greatest generation parents, et cetera, at least if you're my age. the problem was, you were shown a game of failure, but then you had to fight through to try and do the best you can. You know the saying, oh, you fail 7 out of 10 times, you're a Hall of Famer in baseball. If you shoot 30% in basketball, if you can complete 30% of your passes in football, you're not playing.
Yeah.
So the problem that I saw coaching kids at a young age, and a young age, I mean 8, 10, 12, 14 even, when they get that failure, when they hit that failure, they're like, man, I'll go play basketball. I'll go play football. I agree baseball was slow, but it was slow when we were kids. But if you're really into the game, it's not slow. If you're sitting in the stands analyzing it, if you're playing in the game analyzing it, they say outfield is the most boring thing in the world. Well, I pitched, but I played center field mostly, high school, college, semi-pro in the Central Park leagues. And I remember thinking in center field, I didn't, as the center fielder, didn't have enough time to think between pitches in terms of what am I going to do? What am I going to tell the guy to the left and right of me? I love center field because every ball is yours. And so I think the problem is game of failure then, game of failure now, how we dealt with the game of failure. And I'm a parent, so I have to take, it's partly my generation's fault, although God bless my kid, he loves baseball.
Right.
But game of failure then, game of failure now, we dealt with failure differently than kids today deal with failure.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, hashtag kids these days, but yeah, no, that's true.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's just, it's a game that doesn't have a clock.
Right.
Fantastic.
You know, and it's a game, the only game where the defense has the ball.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many unique things.
Yep.
And to go back to where we were talking about earlier with the outfield, like you played outfield, Steve, is at the high school level, we move on the count.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a right-handed batter, for example, and the first pitch is a strike, we're moving three steps to right field because we're going to throw our pitch now. We're ahead.
Right.
So there's so many games within the game, as you had mentioned, Steve, that makes it like a huge chess game.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term.
Exactly. And these are the kind of issues I think that Rob Manfred's going to have to look at before he goes making any rash decisions, because, you know, how the game kind of works itself out with the whole cycle of you know, making adjustments and counter adjustments and all of that. We're still, I think, early in the cycle of the pendulum swinging the other way. Also, to your point, Steve, about if you shoot 30% in basketball, then your name's Dion Waiters. I can tell you that from I can tell you from bitter experience. Thank God he's gone,
yeah,
eh, Ken?
I can second that, yeah.
Never liked that show, and I tell you what.
No.
But as far as it goes for this winter, any other notes that you guys have? I'll start with you, Steve. I know from talking to you off air, you got some thoughts on the signing of Ichiro with the Marlins, but any other notes from this winter that we haven't talked about, guys?
Yeah, I just want to speak briefly on Ichiro. And look, I was so happy that he came to New York. We know he wasn't the 370 Ichiro, but I watched him play virtually every game as a Yankee. I took my kid to watch him play. The preparation, the stretching, the weirdness, whatever, the hitting balls that bounce for base hits. I mean, just amazing. But I thought the Yankees did disrespect, and I told you guys off air. He signed a one-year, $2 million deal with the Marlins. I had written an article some time ago. I didn't think he was going to go back to the Yankees because there were some rumors during the season and a couple of reports about things that had happened. And I thought Ichiro, as a four-tool player, not power, although he could jerk one out every once in a while, as I wrote, he used to run like the wind. He still runs well. He used to throw like Clemente. He still throws well. An excellent hitter. Look, the guy hit 284 for the Yankees last year. And on a team of 230 and 240, 10, 15, 20 million years, pick any player, you know, Teixeira, pick any of them. The catcher hit 240. I mean, it just drove me wacky. He hit 40 points higher than every starter except Gardner, who hit like 270.
Yeah.
And Brian McCann I was talking about,
yeah,
who hit like 230 or 240. Mm-hmm. I'm not knocking any of those guys. But don't tell me that you were paying, and this has come from Yankee fans now, you paid Ichiro too much. My point was, the article I wrote was, look, if the Yankees, and I am not a Mets fan, as you would imagine, but I wrote, if the Yankees don't re-sign him and they're not going to, the Mets should take a run at him, because who more would you like? I think the Mets can make a run next year. We'll talk about it another time. But who more would you like in the locker room than a guy who can still play, who can still hit, who's been to the playoffs, both with Seattle early on and with the Yankees later? What better guy could you have than Sandy Alderson, who doesn't want to spend 10 cents? Could have got Ichiro, I'm guessing. Now, maybe Ichiro didn't want to come back to New York, although I think he would have in that proud Japanese, let me go over there and hit 300 and show these guys what I could do.
Sure.
So I know Ichiro is a small signing in the overall scheme of things, but I think he's going to get 3,000 hits. He needs 156. That's 2 years, not one. And I was just shocked that he went to the Marlins for 1 year for $2 million. And, oh, by the way, he's going to help them.
Well, by the way, also, just showing that it all ties together in the FDH lounge, as we always like to say, going back to the point about Rob Manfred starting to confront the shift, the Yankees are a prototypical team here, favoring left-hand power with the right-field porch that they have
right here.
That's a big reason for the guys getting holes in their swing. McCann and everybody else, those are guys that weren't able to beat the shift to share on down the line. They're a team, I think, that gets hurt by it probably disproportionately. And, again, I think when you wrote about it a few years ago, Steve, and you were one of the first on the topic, weren't you addressing it when Joe Maddon was doing it against the Yankees and when the reaction in New York to what was happening there?
Well, what happened was, and again, I give my son credit, he was a Tino Martinez fan. And when mm-hmm. he was traded to Tampa Bay and my son was like nine, he said, the Yankees will never win with Jason Giambi, and from now on I'm rooting for Tampa Bay. And God bless him, he did.
Yeah.
He roots for the Patriots and Tampa Bay, two fantastic organizations.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. What happened was, opening day,
mm-hmm.
They had, you know, David Cohn, Michael Kay, whoever. They went into this long, well, things may be changing now. You know, Joe Maddon and Tampa, they shift on the Yankees, and that could be the start of something. And I wrote an article,
mm-hmm.
the defensive revolution has been televised for 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, where have these guys been? Because now, now I think it's been a legitimate 3 or 4 years. I mean, this is
yeah.
not new anymore.
Right.
And, of course, they copied Joe Maddon and Tampa Bay. Whatever you think of Maddon, I think he's a great manager.
Mm-hmm.
But they mm-hmm. were the first to do it. The sabermetrics with the shifts, et cetera. Now everybody does it. They were easily the first. It's just funny how long it took some of these teams, including the Yankees, 3 years to come to the party. Now, Tampa Bay shifts on virtually every batter to some degree.
Yes.
People aren't quite there yet. But, yeah, that changed the way the game was played. And in a game where you think everybody knows everything forever,
right.
here's another recent thing that – obviously revolutionized the game. The flip side, I just wanted to mention psychologically,
mm-hmm.
I heard an interview with a Big Poppy, and he said, oh, yeah, the shift cost me 35 hits a year. Well, if the shift cost him 35 hits a year, he'd be hitting, you know, 350, 360, 380. So that's not true. But I think it's in their mind. Teixeira admitted that it was. It's in their mind that these shifts caused them. I don't think they do anything different because they still pull the ball and they line out to the second baseman who's 35 feet into the outfield.
Exactly.
But I don't think you lose 35 hits, but I absolutely think you lose, you know, 10, 15 hits a year, and that's 20, 30 points on your average. So it's psychological as well, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. And right after you wrote your column there on WFAN, the Wall Street Journal, I remember, wrote a column about that as well. Apparently they read WFAN and follow that for their trend-setting topics.
Not the first time, Rick.
If the Journal would only stop ripping you off.
Oh.
Well, what do you think, Ken? Any other notes from this winter or anything happening with the state of the game you want to talk about?
Well, Yeah, going back to what Steve said about Ichiro, he could probably play for two-thirds of this team starting outfield. Right here in town, he could play.
With the way that power is declining, absolutely. He's losing what little power he ever had, but baseball's losing power at a more rapid rate than he is.
Absolutely. Right. And you know what? With the sabermetrics, they've got their place, and they've done good with some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the game will adjust itself. Yes. Again, being a pitching coach, I've had parents come up to me and said, well, my son is throwing 100 pitches right now. And I said, well, he threw 40 in the bullpen. He throws five in between each inning, and that's seven innings. So we're at 75 pitches already, and he hasn't faced anybody. So I said, and if you could tell me, I would give you the deed to my home. Who created the 100 pitch? Why isn't it 85? Why isn't it 111? And no one has ever been able to, I mean, people come up with this stuff. Like you just said, 35 hits it cost him. Where did this come from? Did we just imagine this stuff?
Yeah. I think that's a separate show, Rick. We should show on that pitch counts and
we
stuff.
Should.
I'd love
you
to
know,
talk about that.
It just frosts me to death.
We should.
Every parent who's a soccer mom or whatever else comes in there and just chastises me. And I said, well, we keep a pitch count.
Yeah.
But, you know, the first time they used a pitch count was Nolan Ryan back in, I believe, early 70s against Louis Tion.
Mm-hmm.
They both went 12 innings. One pitched over 212 pitches. Another one pitched 174 approximately.
Yep.
So I bring this up to parents who don't know duh about this stuff.
Right.
But yet we're, you know, got to be nice to the parents. Got to tell them that their little Johnny's not going to get hurt. Bob Feller used to say, and you know we had him on our show back in the day, throw as much as you can. They didn't have Tommy John surgeries like they have right now.
Right.
They're going in and out. And I think, Steve, you're right on. I'm going to shut up right now because that is a total different show.
I'll say it again. Baseball, hardest game to play, hardest game to coach, hardest game to learn, game of failure. But, yeah, I think Ken's on to something. We could do a whole show on that because I have lots of thoughts on pitch counts. But that's for another day.
Absolutely, yeah. And, hey, who knows if it'll be the FDH Lounge or if it'll be Life's a Pitch with Ken Detweiler since that's coming back. You never know. And let me just seize on one other note that you said there, Ken, when you said that you would bet this woman the deed to your house. I can say from being at your recent housewarming party, that's quite a dare on your part. How lovely new abode that you have there.
He meant the old house.
Yeah, you've been at the old house.
I've been to three of them now since I've
right.
known you. And actually, they're all
right.
very nice. That rec room is pretty boss, by the way.
That is nice.
Really like it. And that will perhaps be the scene of some future shows here. Taking
Absolutely.
It on the road.
Yeah,
we're sitting here in the Coventry neighborhood of Cleveland Heights, Ohio tonight. So glad to catch good friend Steve Callis when he's in town here. And again, you can also catch him with his show on the STN.net. You can catch that the Steve Callis show as well as appearances WFAN, SNY, etc. So it's great to be here with Steve. It's great to be here with you, Ken, and looking forward to your show coming back and the three of us having some great discussions
Absolutely.
There as well as here. So, guys, this was just a wonderful discussion, as I knew it would be. I can't thank both of you enough, and I know I speak for the audience in that regard as well. Great baseball talk with the two of you, as always.
This was a lot of fun. Can't wait to do it again with both of you.
Yeah, and that ditto for me. And just like every time the three amigos get together, it is just the adrenaline. Now, I'm going to be just so pumped all night long with the conversations we've had here today.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Thank you both.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it. And thank you all for tuning in to this mini episode of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.